Welcome to the Optimal Body Podcast. I'm Doc Jen.
And I'm Dr. Dom, and we are doctors of physical therapy, bringing you the body tips and physical therapy pearls of wisdom to help you begin to understand your body, relieve your pains and restrictions, and answer your questions.
Along with expert guests, our goal of the Optimal Body Podcast is really to help you discover what optimal means within your own body. Let's dive in. Before we get into this awesome episode, I have to talk about something I've been adding in to my routine real quick, because let me tell you, these two littles that we have feel like they're constantly sick. Someone is throwing up, or someone has a fever, or someone has a runny nose, and it has just been a constant cycle. So believe it or not, we've added in honey, and this is not just any kind of honey. Let me tell you, this is Manicora honey, which is rich, creamy, and truly the most delicious honey I've ever had. I'm not kidding. It's ethically produced in the remote forests of New Zealand. And here's what sets this honey apart. The bees gather nectar from the Manicora tea tree, which is packed with bioactives that give this honey three times more antioxidants and prebiotics than regular honey. And these support your cells, your gut, where most of our immune system actually lives. And so in the winter, when you're dealing with the colder weather, the busy travel schedules, and more time indoors, these nutrients become really especially helpful. And something else that Manicora honey has is it naturally contains MGO, which is a rare antibacterial compound that sets it apart from other honeys. And I feel so comfortable adding this in now that Luca is one, because it could be on my fingers. He can lick it off and I don't feel worried anymore. It's truly a game changer, and all you need is one heaping scoop, one little teaspoon each morning, and it gets the most out of these amazing bioactives in Manicora. Now, it's easier than ever to try Manicora honey, so we want you to head to manicora.com/docjen, and you actually save 31% plus $25 worth of free gifts with their starter kit, and that includes an MGO 850 plus Manicora honey jar, 5 honey travel sticks, and a wooden spoon and a guidebook so that you understand how to really use this. Now, that's manucora.com/docjen, and you save 31% plus that $25 worth of free gifts. And I'm telling you, this is honey like no other, and it has been essential right now so that I can function and keep myself healthy around these two littles.
Today, we're so excited to be welcoming in a guest who's going to be talking about vision and eyesight and why those might not be exactly the same thing. Dr. Bryce Applebaum is a neurooptometrist passionate about unlocking human potential through vision and the founder and CEO of My Vision First, a leading private practice specializing in diagnosing and treating functional vision problems across all ages. Dr. Applebaum is a trusted authority in functional vision, an international TEDx speaker, and the creator of Vision Performance Training, a transformative approach that optimizes the eye-brain connection, heals post-concussion vision issues, and builds long-term visual resilience. Through his work with My Vision First and ScreenFit, his revolutionary online vision training program, Dr. Applebaum has supported thousands of patients around the world to thrive in a screen-heavy society, because 20/20 eyesight isn't the whole story. And I'm so excited for you to go through this interview, because he talks about drills that you can even do while you're sitting here listening. Let's get into it. All right, Dr. Bryce, thank you so much for being with us. We were talking before we came on that how as PTs, we kind of nerd out when someone wants to talk about eyesight and vision. And so we're so excited to have you on so we can jump into it a little bit.
Such an honor to be here. Appreciate you having me. And I love how you're talking about eyesight and vision as different things, because most people not in the therapeutic space have no idea what that even means. And if we recognize those as different entities, then everything we say today makes a lot more sense.
Okay, that's very interesting. Why are they different? I think, you know, can we just start there? Why are they so different?
So think of eyesight as a symptom. Eyesight's our ability to focus light clearly. That's what most people go to the eye doctor for, where they put you in the back of that dark exam room. You have to read the small letters far away. But there's so much more to vision than just 20/20 eyesight. So vision is how our brain filters, organizes, processes, stores all the input coming in through the eyes, how it makes sense of that, derives meaning, and then directs the appropriate action. So think of eyesight as glasses or contacts. Vision is brain, and vision problems are brain problems. And there are solutions for brain problems, especially functional vision problems, in the form of vision therapy, vision performance training, which is essentially what you guys are absolute experts in with physical therapy, but for the eyes, really for the brain through the eyes.
So, you know, talking about what we learn in physical therapy, we learn about all of the muscles that attach to the eyes and how they move the eyes and which way they're supposed to, and also the tracking of the eyes and smooth pursuit versus saccades, if I have that right. And the way that our eyes move. Is that included in what this grouping of vision, you know, what our vision is?
Interrupting real quick. This is your reminder. Are you hydrating? Do you have a jug of water next to you? Are you actually drinking? Now, here is the key point. As we go into the new year and you want to maintain a healthier you, I know you want to because you're listening to the Optimal Body Podcast. Hydration isn't just about drinking water. Being optimally hydrated is about optimizing our body's fluid ratios. And this fluid balance depends on many factors, including the intake and excretion of electrolytes. And this is why Dom and I preach we use every single day Element. That's L-M-N-T. We put it into our water once a day. And we even put just like from our water bottle, a tiny bit into our kids so that they drink more water because the flavors are so delicious. Now, here's the thing. Electrolytes are charged minerals that conduct electricity to power our nervous system. So when you're feeling like that brain fog, you're feeling that energy crash in midday, rather than reaching for another cup of coffee, reach for Element. Get your Element in, especially if you're really focusing on eating more whole foods, getting more activity in throughout the day. We can't just be drinking water to really hydrate ourselves. We want to be getting and replenishing our electrolytes. So if you have not yet checked out Element, I would highly recommend it. Supports our podcast as well. If you go directly to drinkelement.com/optimal, that is drinkelment.com/optimal, and you get a free sample pack with every purchase. And I'm telling you, their sample packs are amazing. You want to try every flavor so that you really figure out which one works best for you. Personally, Dom and I really like the raspberry salt and the citrus salt. That's like the two that we come back to over and over again. But the lemonade, oh my goodness, let me tell you, you got to try it. So if you have not gotten Element yet, just at least purchase one, try it out, and see how you feel throughout the day. Okay, getting back in.
Absolutely. And I would say that's a big piece of the puzzle. What a lot of PT school and OT school teaches is kind of X-axis work. So the across midline stuff. So that's the tracking, that's the pursuits, keeping your attention on something as it changes position. So that's following a ball, watching somebody walk by. The saccades or saccades, depending on how you want to pronounce it, the jumps from one place to another, that's really the eye movements needed for reading. Then there's the Z-axis, which is the depth perception and how we engage with our world. And that's the eye coordination of the convergence and the divergence and the focusing system. So really the inside and outside muscles of the eyes and how well they work together as a team.
How does that relate to, you know, our brain health? And why is that kind of... why do we need to include vision when we're talking about brain health, and how does that kind of play a role together?
So I know I'm biased, but that is everything when it comes to brain health. So vision is a direct reflection of brain function. And very often, eyesight is also directly related to vision. So somebody who's noticing that far away keeps getting blurrier, whether it's a child still developing their vision or an adult who's stuck on a screen all day long, far away often gets blurry because of a near problem, whether it's a focusing stamina problem with the eye focusing muscles, an eye coordination problem, a tracking problem, whatever that is. If the brain is taxed and is working on overdrive just to get the eyes to point, focus, converge, to then process that information, becomes brain. And then really the symptom of blur far away is because of near. If our focusing system's acting like an old school camera lens that's on manual focus instead of autofocus, then far away gets blurry. We treat the symptom, here's stronger glasses, And then that just keeps changing year after year until we recognize the problem, which when we address the problem, the symptom is less likely of an option or no longer an option. So people listening, especially adults whose eyeglasses prescription is changing every year, that's, in my opinion, diagnostic of a functional vision problem. It's not normal. It's common that that happens, but it's probably because you're under visual stress from too much screen time or not having the foundation in place from your environment to meet the demands. And then simply put, you adapt or you avoid as the two solutions.
So you were kind of alluding to this, say in a young child, and you talk about this a lot on your website and in your content that you put out, how these functional visual disturbances can kind of mask as behavioral challenges, attention issues, other things that kids might get diagnosed with when it may actually be something going on with their visual system. Is this something that you can test for, or when someone comes in thinking that this might be the problem, how do you test to determine, okay, this kid might actually have attention issues versus, hey, there are some visual, you know, functional things that we can really work on here?
I love that we're talking about this. So if you cannot control your eyes and their ability to focus, then you cannot control your mind and its ability to focus. And we are in a reactive medical system that so quickly and easily slaps labels and diagnoses on behaviors. So ADHD, ADD, dyslexia, certain learning differences, even certain executive functioning challenges, those are labels to describe behaviors. And so many of the symptoms and behaviors of hidden functional vision problems are the exact same as those other behaviors. And if you know how to screen for them and look out for them, then you recognize those are incomplete diagnoses unless we're ruling out vision first. So a child or an adult who is a reluctant reader, who's losing their place when they're reading, skipping words, skipping lines, having to reread or not remembering what they're reading. It acts like they seem like they've got ants in their pants when they're trying to do a sustained near concentration task. That is a clear warning sign that the eyes are not working well together as a team. And if that person then prefers to rely on audiobooks or be read to rather than reading on their own, they're not using their dominant sense a vision, they're relying on auditory because it's often too hard to use vision. And it's not like there's a blood test that says, oh yes, you have ADD or ADHD and we can measure biochemical imbalance. It's based off of the symptoms and behaviors. And 15 of the 18 symptoms that are often used for diagnoses of ADHD are the exact same symptoms of functional vision problems. There's such an overlap here. And we could talk about with an expensive piece of equipment, a pen right here, we could talk about 30 seconds of screening tests to do to recognize, do I or does one of my loved ones have a hidden functional vision problem impacting performance, reading, learning, and our ability to achieve our potential? And it's as simple as following across midline, it should be smooth and fluid. Converging down midline, there should be one all the way into our nose. And when we look at a target and we cover up an eye, we shouldn't see what we're looking at moving. And if it is moving, that means the eye was in a different place and it's having to reposition or redirect to maintain a single clear image. And there are so many people struggling unnecessarily with hidden functional vision problems because nobody knows what to look for. And especially in the eye care world, we're all trained on this reactive model, intervening when there's disease and looking at structure rather than a proactive model looking at function. No child is born with the ability to read, or with the ability to track or converge, or even with the ability to see in depth in 3D. That's all developed through our life experiences. And it's either learned appropriately through the right sequencing of developmental milestones, or learned poorly, leading to vision imbalances. And these problems are now everywhere because screens are a huge part of our lives. They're being introduced at early and earlier ages. People are being asked to read earlier than ever before. And when we're not visually ready, that's when a lot of these challenges emerge.
So do you think that's a lot of the issue is that, I see even babies on screens nowadays and, you know, so like you said, screens being introduced, but also that's interesting that reading is being introduced too soon. So how do you know if your kid should be getting challenged in a way that's, you know, getting them developmentally ready to read and to start to do things. But what if it's too soon? Like, how can a parent start to see some of these signs?
I mean, especially with developmental milestones early on, like until the child's ready to walk, they're not going to walk, right? Like they have to hit the benchmarks beforehand. So if we're introducing sight words and we're asking a child to start reading with us and there's resistance, that is so telling, right? That they're not quite ready for that. And, you know, there's certain vision problems that are so much more likely to be present in someone who's diagnosed with ADHD. Convergence insufficiency, 3 times more likely in children diagnosed with ADHD. Strabismus or an eye turn, 2 times as likely. Even uncorrected hyperopia, farsightedness, or astigmatism, 2 times the odds of having those with somebody who's diagnosed with ADHD. So I think it's as simple as not trying to force something or expect something out of our children. I mean, everyone's going to get to the point where they're reading with the right foundation, with the right skills in place. But when we're pushing it on somebody too soon, I mean, if we're having to show a child a sight word and 2 exposures, 3, 10, 20, and it's like, just way, it's almost like in their brain and then gone, they likely haven't developed the visual memory yet to store that image and to put together that sequence of letters, to decode, to create the label and the language that comes with that. And it's likely because it's really hard for their brain to process visual input because it's hard for their eyes to work together. And then there's also children who start reading super early in life. And I would say that's not something you want to, you know, avoid. I mean, that's something that's wonderful. Yeah. You want to feed that, but you also want to have balance and get them outside and engaging with 3-dimensional space and developing the bilateral integration and the core stability and the ability for vision to guide motor, like you guys know all so well, which is really the foundational building blocks for which we develop vision from. I mean, kids who skip over crawling or walk too soon have such a greater likelihood of developing an eye turn or lazy eye, because they haven't developed that reciprocal body movement to be able to have vision guide movement and have the world go from static to then being dynamic.
Now you're talking my language with getting outside and moving, because I am not a reader. I probably, if I went back and did some true reading tests, might have some issues tracking with how quickly, you know, I feel like I'm a very slow reader because of it, because I haven't, you know, stroked that groove. I haven't trained that very much.
Well, let me ask you a question. Did you play ball sports growing up?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
So for somebody like you, there's probably a very different visual profile in 3-dimensional space versus in 2D space. Like tracking a ball coming at you is a very different skill set than making very precise tracking eye movements on a screen, especially when screens cause our visual system to lock up and cause often a misperception of where something's located in space. Wow. But then, you know, the child who avoids ball sports because it's hard for them to know where the ball is, so it's going to be that much harder to anticipate where it's going to be and prepare their body for what's coming. You know, asking that child to read is a travesty, because there's no chance they're going to be able to do that if they can't control eye movements in their natural resting position of where their eyes are focusing far away.
Mm. Oh, that's a great point.
And if you think about eye movements, like, we're meant to have a visual system that scans the horizon in natural light for the saber-tooth tiger coming at us.
Yeah.
Not making those same eye movements on a 2D device inches from our face, blasting high energy light at us for hours on end. The average 8 to 10-year-old in America spends 6 hours a day on screens.
Yeah.
The average adult, 7 hours and 4 minutes. That's average. We're not meant to be doing that. And so, you know, I think to your point, like, you probably feel safe and more regulated outside when you can explore a 3-dimensional space. I mean, that's something that so many kids have to be dragged outside, even if they're getting outside at all. Many are just kind of stuck with tablets and inside and in the dark all day. And that leads to a sedentary lifestyle and so much scary stuff down the road.
It's funny you bring that up. Like, my little daily meditation is right after our recording here, I'm going to take our dog outside. I either go to an outfield with her where I can throw a ball, throw a frisbee for her, run back and forth, or go on the hiking trails with her for half an hour to just, like, yeah, it feels so at peace for me. But, you know, beside the point, it's just funny that you say that and it makes so much sense to me. Screens. You've brought it up a few times here, the challenge with screens and how much we are in front of screens. Yes, to an extent, we can try and reduce the amount of time that we are on screens, that our kids are on screens, but it is also kind of the necessary evil that these screens and this technology have given us so much ability. I mean, we're recording a podcast through computers right now, so it's just like, it's almost ironic that we're talking about how detrimental it can be to something like our visual health, yet it is so necessary. How do we manage that? What can we be doing to try and, you know, hedge against the deleterious effects of being on screens?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not anti-tech. I'm very pro-tech. We heavily utilize tech in my practice. We rely on augmented reality, virtual reality, eye-tracking software even. But I would say most of us don't have the foundation in place to handle screen time all day long. And a child's brain that is underdeveloped is not prepared for screen engagement. We don't know what a lifetime of screen engagement does yet for somebody. And so how do we manage that? I think there's a lot of simple wins that everybody can start today. Number one, taking as many breaks as possible. I always preach the 20-20-20 rule. And what that means is never more than 20 minutes without taking a break for at least 20 seconds and looking at something at least 20 feet away. But that's kind of max. Like taking as many vision breaks as we can, looking away from the screen, ideally looking out a window, ideally getting up and moving. I mean, movement, as you guys know so well, de-stresses so much of our body, but it definitely de-stresses our visual system and allows us to get into this optic flow that's self-generated, where we can navigate through space and allow images to pass by. That kind of creates glue for our eyes to work together. So I always say, unless you're on a podcast and you can't be rude, like get up, go to the bathroom, walk around, do some air squats if you can. So taking breaks is huge. There's definitely certain setups in terms of glasses that can be really protective. We always promote digital performance lenses, which is a particular type of prescription that's therapeutic in nature, not compensatory, doesn't do the work for you. So it's not like normal glasses that take something blurry and makes it clear, and then often you adapt to that and you need something stronger to maintain that same clarity. These would be glasses that give your brain a better opportunity for your eyes to work together by decreasing some of the visual stress associated with near. So that could be a really small amount of balanced magnification, a small amount of balanced prism, but basically allowing performance to stay steady or optimized over time. And I am a big proponent of every child should be in digital performance lenses to make screens less terrible. But also as a parent of three young kids, like there's a time and a place for screens. Like tablets, my kids are on tablets, but they are only allowed tablets for 15 minutes twice a day. And they know they're wearing their DPLs. And if they're not, mom and dad are going to yell at them, and that doesn't fly. So having that right setup is huge. And then getting up and engaging with three-dimensional space, like the climbing in trees that we did as kids, the playing ball in our neighborhood, the looking at clouds and visualizing and thinking about what those clouds are rather than looking at a picture of a cloud on a screen in your dark dungeon of a basement. I mean, that does wonders for visual development and cognitive development. And then on top of that, just like we train our bodies, we can train our eye-brain connection at any age for any brain to be able to handle screen time without it causing bad things to occur, without causing these maladaptations and the disruption to vision development and overall visual health.
So what is that? How do we start to train that aspect? And I love everything you're saying. I mean, obviously, we're all big components of getting up and moving often. We always talk, we say at least 30 minutes, you know, you're sitting down, you're getting up and you're moving, you're doing something.
I always say for movements, it's our 30 for 30 rule. Every 30 minutes, you got to take at least 30 seconds to move your body and the opposite direction that you're sitting in.
But I like the 20-20-20 because now we're thinking about the eyesight as well as to where we're going. Yeah. And we've also talked about so much of how that stimulates the brain in a different way to reduce pain symptoms. You know, so it's all starting to play a role together.
So just like we can exercise and strengthen our body, and I would hope that most people listening to you are doing that daily at some level, we can also exercise and strengthen the eye-brain connection. So for some reason, you know, we train balance, we train mobility, but some people think that we just shouldn't or couldn't, or there's no file on training vision. I mean, these are sensory systems that should be tying together all of the other input from all of our other sensory systems. And when we don't know better, we can't really do better. So, I mean, there's simple eye exercises that are great for everybody to do, just like walking and, you know, sit-ups, air squats, and push-ups can be really helpful for a lot of things. And that could be something as simple as eye push-ups or eye stretches or near far focus. And we could talk about any or all of these. But then there's also, you know, an entire specialty with vision performance training and with vision therapy where we are using the eyes to rewire the brain to change how we're using vision, but to establish order from disorder, to establish development that maybe didn't take place the way it was supposed to. From a rehab standpoint, from a concussion or brain injury, I mean, there are more areas of our brain dedicated to processing vision, not eyesight, than all of the other senses combined. 2/3 of the neurons coming into our brain come from our eyes. So you can't have a concussion or a head injury and not have vision be impacted. It's just a matter of at what level. And, you know, there's so many ways to get across that start line, whether it's an online vision training program like ScreenFit, whether it's in office with somebody board certified in this space. I mean, there's so many areas of opportunity for improvement, whether that's somebody who's struggling with reading and learning, somebody who gets motion sick, somebody who doesn't trust what they're seeing and hesitant over, you know, going on stairs or escalators, or trouble driving at night, or bumping into walls, knocking things over when they're just around their house. I mean, those are clear signs of the eyes and the brain not working as well together as they're supposed to.
There's a lot of things you said right there that piqued questions that I have. First off, you said when we were kids and we climbed trees. I still climb trees. If I see a tree that I think is a good climbing tree, I got to get up that thing. So maybe that just says something.
That's awesome.
Maybe that just says a little something about me. During COVID, we had these trees around our apartment building that, like, they had these perfect knots that were like, it was like a rock climbing wall, but.
That's a jungle gym for a kid, right?
Oh, man. Like, yeah.
And 20... you have to think about, where am I placing my hands? Your motor planning, your visually directing movement, you're allowing spatial awareness to be tapped into.
Yeah. A 30 plus year old kid. But let's go with eye pushups. I like to do a lot of pushups. That's something that I do every day just to, as a parent of young kids, keep my body active. An eye pushup, I'm struggling to visualize.
All right, so let's do it together. Take a hand, cover up one eye.
Okay.
Take your other hand, stick your thumb up like you're giving somebody a thumbs up. Look at the tip of your finger. Look at the nail. Make it as clear as you can and slowly bring it towards you, keeping it clear until it gets a little blurry. And then when it gets a little blurry, stop. Lock in, look really hard. Try and visualize stimulating your focusing system. Anybody watching, you will notice your pupils getting really small because you're focusing muscles behind the pupil. So you're looking hard, you're locking it in, you're holding it for 5 seconds. Then you're looking all the way across the room as far into the distance as you can for 5 seconds. And back at your finger for 5 seconds, back into the distance. So this is a gross stimulation, relaxation, stimulation, relaxation. You want to do it the same amount of time with one eye as you do with the other. And most people will notice that that thumb can get a little closer with one eye than it can with the other, which means literally your focusing system is engaging with different planes. So under two eye conditions, that means you're actually using one eye more than the other, depending on whether you're reading a book at that distance or the distance a little bit farther back. If you do this every day, you'll literally notice that the thumb can get closer, even if it's a millimeter closer a week. Millimeters add to centimeters, centimeters add to inches, inches add to that much more. I have countless patients who do this every day and they literally don't need stronger reading glasses or reading glasses at all, or their prescriptions won't change, or they're noticing that the ability, the desire to pull a tablet in or lean real close no longer is needed. They can start to hold things farther away. And this is no equipment. This is something you can do when you're on the toilet at a stoplight. I mean, 30 seconds a day, each eye is better than nothing. And something like that, as simple as it is, you're literally establishing flexibility and stamina with your focusing system that before listening to this, you didn't even know that was a thing.
That's kind of funky. And you can feel that. Like you, it's kind of like focusing a camera. You can feel your eye like...
In that camera analogy, I mean, very often when we're stuck at one plane, so if we're on a book, reading books forever, on a screen forever, that becomes the stress point. And then all of a sudden you get locked in there. So if we can build more flexibility there, literally the world can open up more. And so doing it one eye at a time ensures it's just the focusing system. If we did it both eyes at a time and held the thumb up and brought it close, we're then adding eye coordination in the form of convergence. And so you're using inside muscles and outside muscles. So that's when it gets blurrier. In some cases, you'll see your eyes converge, and you get to a point where it starts to split into two and one eye looks at it and the other one doesn't. And that convergence insufficiency has such a high correlation with inattention. And if you think about it, if you can't focus, converge, if you can't control your eyes and keep them focused, it's going to be that much harder to control your brain and your mind to keep that focused.
I mean, this is so fascinating. And it like it sparks in me too, people who are, you know, we just want the pill, we just want the supplement, we just want the thing that's going to give us back our brain energy and our focus. But it's like, what if we switched it to actually working and improve, just like we talk about exercise and pain? It's like, well, what are you actually going to do to create that long-term shift? And this is...
We have neuroplasticity for every brain at every age, and absolutely when it comes to vision. And yet, I was taught in school, like all other eye doctors, that after age 8, there's this critical period for vision development and you blow out the candles on your 8th birthday, then sorry, what you see is what you get. Mm. As silly as that sounds, that's what's still taught. That's for vision lost, not for vision gained. So if you were to take any of us to cover an eye for 6 months with an eye patch and take it off, your eye would be sensitive to light, but you would still be able to see. You take a 6-year-old and they wear an eye patch for 6 months and take it off, there literally will be eyesight lost. Wow. But in terms of what we can build and establish and rewire, there's an indefinite timeline. And yes, a child's brain is more malleable than a 90-year-old's brain is, but depth perception, eye turns, lazy eyes are brain problems that, if addressed on a brain basis, significantly better outcomes. And something like eye patching, where anyone who's out in the world enough, you see a child at the grocery store who's wearing an eye patch because they're told they have a lazy eye. And it's this mindset that there's a good eye and a bad eye, so you got to cover up the good eye so the bad eye has to work. That's literally treatment from over 100 years ago that's still in place because people don't know this type of work exists. But if we can then teach that seesaw to be more balanced between each eye and the brain to attend and use both eyes simultaneously, and obviously it's complicated work to get there, but then they start acting and functioning like they're a cohesive unit. And there isn't this lopsided seesaw where you're picking one and ignoring the other and going downward on this negative spiral.
I mean, this is huge, especially because I had LASIK surgery. Yeah. He's wearing contacts and now we have 2 kids. So we're like, you guys are screwed.
Well, and it's crazy because your kids are so much better off than we were because of what we now know in terms of science and the proof being in the pudding. If you catch your children early enough developing nearsightedness, you can dramatically influence that trajectory with certain types of contacts that you sleep in at night that are like a retainer for your eyes instead of your teeth, called orthokeratology. There's drops you can use to make it so the focusing system doesn't overfocus. There's specialty contact lenses that shift how our brain's taking in and processing space. But then there's brain training in the form of vision performance training that literally can develop rapport and synergy with these systems so that we don't have to have the same endpoint that we had.
So because you brought it up and I had it down that I wanted to ask you, we previously had someone on the podcast a while back now who talked about nearsightedness or myopia, is it called?
Yeah.
Nearsightedness. Yeah. And how you can train your vision back to 20/20. Is that something that you...
Yeah, let's talk about it. So myopia is far away is blurry, nearsightedness, and up close is usually clearer. Right now, 30% of the world is myopic. It's estimated by 2050 that it will be 50% of the world. And we know the three biggest risk factors: not enough time outdoors in natural light, prolonged near work in the dark, and too much screen time. So we can all be more intentional to make sure that those three areas are less detrimental and we can slow down the progression. But then also, there are many cases where if you're addressing the root cause and the problem, not the symptom, you can improve distance clarity. And many patients we see an improvement in eyesight, far away, up close, sometimes even both, by getting their focusing systems to have that much more strength and flexibility. So in many cases, you can reverse myopia. In almost every case, you can slow it down. And in most cases, you can also stop it. But you have to know the right work to do. And you can't always trust what you see and read on the internet, as you guys know.
Yeah.
So it's often not just the palming and the sunning that all of a sudden make it so, oh, you don't have to wear glasses anymore. But we so often hold stress in our eyes and within our visual system.
Yeah.
And if we can alleviate that stress, if we can be more open in our world, if we can integrate central and peripheral visual processing, then yeah, things can shift, and they can shift really dramatically when you're being guided or led by a team or somebody who knows what they're doing.
I mean, that's amazing. And I think, like, for us who have the young children and they're growing up, and you did say that there's things that they could, if we did catch it, you know, there's steps that we could be taking to kind of help. But preventively, is there things that we could do before we even catch that they might be nearsighted?
Absolutely. And I hope this doesn't come across as me like preaching and say it's so easy to do. But if you're limiting screen time early on, that right there is a massive win. Because screen time is directly related to myopia progressing, and especially with young kids. I have 11-year-old twins and a 7-year-old. Both of my 11-year-old twins showed signs of myopia or nearsightedness early on, one at age 4, one at age 6. The one at 4, it was a pretty substantial amount and imbalance between each eye. They're 11 now and both have perfect eyesight and do not wear glasses. And my 7-year-old showed signs of more complicated stuff as well. And she's also not in glasses. All three did a lot of vision training with us because they had to and they knew who their dad was. But we're not a house that supports screen time at an early age as a babysitter. And, you know, in general, the bigger the screen, the farther away, the better. So if you're having them FaceTime with a loved one, it is so important to FaceTime with a loved one who's not local, but mirror it onto the television and have them look at the TV far away, because it's a very different visual skill set needed to engage with a 60-inch TV across the room than it is to talk to grandma, like, you know, 6 inches from their face. So something like that is simple and easy to do. But getting your kids outside, as silly as that sounds, we now know that natural lighting and enough of it can be protective for developing nearsightedness. And there's a bunch of studies, but clear ones that say at least 90 minutes a day outside every day, and ideally 2 hours, slows down the development of nearsightedness from a progression and a severity standpoint.
Wow.
And so much of this also, I mean, research often doesn't follow clinical practice like it's supposed to. I mean, there's a really interesting article that says the average piece of clinical research doesn't get put into practice until 17 years after it's published. We have clear information about nearsightedness now.
Yeah.
And it's not enough, but it lets us know if we're intentional, you know, you can have a different route that the kids are progressing on.
Yeah, and hopefully we don't have to wait another 15 to 17 years for the majority of people to start putting that into practice. And it's unfortunate also sometimes that there's the draw especially from the monetization side and the commercial side of a lot of these practices, that those are perceived as routes that don't make as much money. And so they may not be pursued as heavily or as readily because people don't understand exactly how to implement it in a way that still makes their practice money, which is kind of the sad reality sometimes.
An eye doctor talking about how we can avoid needing glasses, right? Like, and that's, shouldn't make a lot of sense to some people, but I mean, simple rules. Like if you're on your tablet for X amount of time, you got to be outside for at least that much time as well. And I'm sorry, that's the rule. Yeah. Or wearing the right type of supportive lenses when on the screen, or, you know, making sure they're being read too while they're, while you're reading along with them. And I would imagine your kids, you're doing movement with them at all different levels all day long. Movement de-stresses our visual system. And so, I mean, there's so much that can open up our world, you know, if we're putting the right habits in place and they're modeling their parents' behavior as well. Right. Like if you're saying you're not allowed to be on your tablet and then you're just sitting there buried in your tablet all day, like that's like saying don't eat junk food. And then the first thing you want to do is eat junk food because they're seeing everybody else eat junk food.
Yeah. That's, I mean, we do our best. We are definitely a screen limiting household, especially with how young our kids are. But we talk about it often that we need to be so much more cognizant of how much we're on our phone, looking at our phone to check an email, looking at our phone to, you know, when you work from home. That's the sad reality of it too, is they're going to occasionally see us on our computer or our phone, but how do we do that in a way that might not be in front of them all the time, or might be, hey, mama or dada needs to go to work. So we step into a different room for a second while we do that. I'm also just curious because you asked about my ball sport plan, and I played football in college, definitely sustained a number of undiagnosed concussions based on what I felt and do or don't remember from those moments. What can concussion do in either very severe cases or people who have repeated subconcussive head trauma? Like what might that do to our visual systems?
Yeah. So National Institutes of Health, a mile down the road from my office in Bethesda, Maryland, says 28% of Americans have had at least one concussion in their lifetime. And most people don't realize that their present day symptoms or struggles are often related to or tied to a previous head injury. And maybe it was a playground accident when you're younger, you hit your head on the countertop in the kitchen, or in your case, like, you know, there's been repeated head injury. I'm a big believer that the visual symptoms and visual consequences of a concussion, the symptoms can improve, but the problems do not. Our brain just learns how to adapt and bypass them unless we're doing work to tap into those areas. And some of the most common symptoms and struggles after head injury are light sensitivity, sensory overload in environments that have a lot of visual stimuli, like the mall or the grocery store. And it's like, oh my God, get me out of here. Dizziness, nausea, headaches, eye strain when you're reading or on screens, visual memory problems, visual processing problems. You know, I think with a head injury, with the right work, right motivation, right compliance, pretty much every head injury can get back to previous level of function, often even a better place, but it requires the right type of work, having access to it, and then being able to do that type of work. And we know with repeated head injuries, things shift. And so often it's not just the severity of the injury that matters, even like the smallest little acceleration or decelerations of our brainstem, whiplash, or even like a little bump to the head. Even though it's small trauma, it can have a massive influence on function. And so often we're going to the ER or the primary care doctor who's like, you got your bell rung, you're fine. Or go sit in a dark room and don't do anything and it's just going to get better. Neither of those are right. Every concussion is a unique animal. And so it has to be treated on a unique, customized basis. But I mean, you can also get concussions and head injuries if you're not playing football and doing all the stuff that you can. They happen in life. And so just being mindful of the visual stress that comes with reading and writing and desk work, like having a concussion and then having somebody have to go to school all day, navigate the classroom, the halls, or go to work all day, that can almost step on an open wound and disallow an opportunity for healing.
How does someone or who does someone go to assess whether they are still having post-concussive symptoms, if they're having visual impairments due to a concussion? Like, how can someone start to learn that about themselves and then take action?
So ideally, you're seeing a neurooptometrist or somebody who's board certified in vision development and rehabilitation. There's a wonderful organization called COVD, the College of Optometrists and Vision Development. And they have a locate a doctor section where you can type in your address. It'll give you a radius of doctors within X amount of miles nearby. There's a box you can check off that says if they're board certified. And ideally, from an evaluation standpoint, you're seeing somebody board certified who's doing the right testing, looking at tracking and focusing and depth perception and eye teaming and visual processing and visual memory. And from an evaluation standpoint, you can know, okay, this is not normal, or here the problems are. There's not as much consistency from the treatment standpoint. It's not like a sprained MCL where grade one, you're getting a dozen sessions, grade two, you're getting two dozen. And depending on which PT you go to around town, you're going to get similar outcomes. You don't even have to be board certified to offer vision therapy and rehabilitation. There's now coaches, trainers, teachers, OTs, PTs, speech therapists, all types of practitioners doing vision work because the need is so high. And I think that's wonderful. But oftentimes it barely scratches the surface in terms of what can be done to rewire the brain. And you just want to make sure you're going to somebody who has experience in this space. And the ER, I mean, if there's concern, you go to the ER, you get the boxes checked off, but a CAT scan, CT scan is not going to show what's occurring neurologically. That requires a functional MRI or SPECT scan, something that looks at brain activity. And there's hardly any of those anywhere, but it really should be based off of symptoms, behaviors, disruption and function. And then from there, just getting the right team to provide the support that you deserve.
Yeah. And I know, like, we've interviewed our PT friend, Molly Parker, who had severe post-concussive symptoms, severe. And it took her years to find
motor issues,
right kind of team. And she does a lot of visual work as well. But like you said, it is a team of people who has to come together, and like, and it's not always easily accessible. It's not always easy to find. And so how do people just continue to learn about improving this functional vision aspect and what they can do? Like, where could people go?
I mean, I think we're getting to a place now where so much is accessible when you do enough digging, when you are your own advocate. And unfortunately, healthcare lets a lot of people down. So number one, like, I'm a big proponent of putting your vision first. Think about vision being a big piece of the puzzle or playing a role in that recovery or in that missing piece to the puzzle. So on the internet, I mean, there's different organizations that provide really good feedback. There's COVD, like I mentioned. There's an organization called NORA, Neurooptometric Rehabilitation Association. And then there's people like myself who just put a lot of content out on Instagram and YouTube and social media, because I look at this as, if we can impact one person who was unnecessarily struggling and didn't know about this until my goofy video about why somebody's patterned shirt makes you feel like you want to throw up after you had a head injury, like, that should at least spark some interest. And then, you know, I think finding out who in your area or who of your circle has had similar challenges, and then just word of mouth and getting the right paths to that treatment that you deserve. That's what's needed. I would say the gap is getting so wide now, and we're at such a turning point in healthcare where those who take a proactive approach and look at holistically the whole person and root cause are starting to speak the same language as a lot of other practitioners in that space. And then you kind of get directed to what you know makes sense, and then what is just a missed opportunity or a misdiagnosis.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much here. There's so much that I want to continue to dive in on. I think I'll throw one last question at you, because we've been talking mostly about disorders or, you know, impairments within the visual system. How would you lobby to somebody who's like, I'm healthy though, I have no problems, I'm a weekend warrior athlete, or I'm a competitive athlete in some sort of sports, professional or otherwise. how could it still be beneficial for them to, like you just said, proactively work on their visual health?
So I would say, at least in my practices, we're typically seeing people with problems, but we also, I work with a bunch of professional sports teams, Olympians, people who already have things pretty solid, but they want that extra 1% and they're looking for that, those marginal gains.
Yeah.
You can, I mean, anyone can be, anyone's brain can be trained to optimize the critical components of their visual system to result in more consistent performance or improved play. And that could be performance on a long car ride. That could be performance chasing your kids around on the weekend. I mean, there's so much there where potential can be unleashed through vision and looking at reaction time and depth perception and peripheral vision. I mean, if we're doing the right testing to look at the right areas, then it's a lot easier to find the solutions. But then even on top of that, if there's areas of opportunity that you wish were easier, there's usually a reason why. And just because as we age, cognitive capacity drops often and visual function often drops, that's common, but that's not normal. That's only happening if there's a challenge. And, you know, looking at brain fog, looking at decreased productivity throughout the workday, looking at visual fatigue, so much can be done with the eyes used as like joysticks to tap into the brain to get different areas of the brain to start talking to each other and allow airplanes to take off and land where they're supposed to.
So where can people go and learn all this stuff from you? Because this, I mean, there, again, there's so much more that I feel like we could ask about, even like myself selfishly. I'd say, like, how did that mess me up? All the things. So,
how did that mess me up?
So I like, where can people continue to learn online courses, work with you? Where could they go?
So we are on a tear just pumping out information now. So My Vision First is our kind of global practice, myvisionfirst.com. And on there we have so many blog pieces, media opportunities, podcasts. We've done close to 50 podcasts in the last year just to raise awareness, which is why I'm so grateful we're able to just educate and empower your community here. Social media, our accounts, Dr. Bryce Applebaum on Instagram is probably our best one. YouTube, I just put out a TED talk or TEDx talk. So I'm just getting started in terms of shouting from a rooftop what's possible. But I think the collaboration like this is so special because clearly people listening are drinking your Kool-Aid and their lives have been enhanced by, all that you're educating and sharing. And so vision should be a big piece of the puzzle. And when we're thinking about, if somebody has a headache, maybe they're going to see the neurologist, or if somebody's got behavioral issues, maybe they're looking to see a neuropsychologist, or motion sickness, an ENT or otolaryngologist. But with almost any symptom, we should at least be considering that vision could be and is likely a piece of the problem. And so just advocating putting your vision first, that goes way beyond just going to your eye doctor and seeing if you need glasses. And I hope there's a lot of take homes, but one of the big ones, there's so much more to vision than just 20/20 eyesight.
I appreciate that. I appreciate all your time and expertise. We'll have your information linked up if people are interested in learning from you. I had seen that TED talk and I didn't get a chance to listen to it before we had you on, but I want to give that a listen. And for me, it is time for me to go get my eyes on the horizon after being on the computer. But I appreciate you being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. We also have an online vision training program called ScreenFit, which is a really effective way just to start doing stuff from home for anybody who's interested. But such a incredible opportunity to get this out there. So appreciate you both so much.
This was such a fascinating episode. If you heard something that you think can be supportive for someone else, please pass this episode along. We can't just have you listen because it helps to get it out to so many more people and we can't do it without your support. Now, if you want to check out ScreenFit, they actually gave us a discount code. We'll have it linked up in the show notes, or you can use code OPTIMAL and you can go to ScreenFit.com/enroll. And so if you want to go check that out, that's screenfit.com/enroll. Use code OPTIMAL for a discount. And again, pass this episode along. We're so grateful to have you here and we'll see you back on another episode of the Optimal Body Podcast.